Welcome to the Journal.ie's The Explainer, where every week we take a deep dive into a different news story. I'm Sinead O'Carroll, and this week, what happens when people need medical attention in Ukraine? This episode is supported by the Directorate General for European Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations. That's DG ECHO for short. The war in Ukraine is more than 2 years old, and it's still grabbing headlines across the world as fighting continues day in, day out on the front lines. Ordinary citizens have either found refuge in other countries or are trying to eke out some kind of normal life where they have always lived. Unfortunately, for some, ordinary life means health problems. Health problems that necessitate treatment, surgeries, and hospital stays. How does that kind of treatment then happen alongside a war? As part of the overall EU response, DG ECHO's Emergency Response Coordination Centre set up what's referred to as the Medevac Hub in the Polish city of Rzeszów near the Ukrainian border. More than 3,000 patients have been transferred there from within Ukraine before then being sent on to participating EU countries, including Ireland, for further treatment. How does all this work, and what can we learn about the day-to-day of modern war by looking at these kinds of initiatives? Today, I'm joined by Eric Adrian, duty officer at the Emergency Response Coordination Centre, that's the ERCC, whose day-to-day work is all about the logistics of making these life-changing events happen. Thanks so much for joining us, Eric. And firstly, people might have started to lose sight of the situation on the ground now that we're over 2 years in. Can you tell us what it's like for both soldiers and ordinary people trying to access healthcare in Ukraine right now?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on your program. Obviously, the situation is quite difficult. I think the last report we received from the WHO indicates that, that over 1,300 health facilities have been targeted during the war. So obviously, there are limited services, especially in the eastern part of the country. And furthermore, the doctors are quite busy dealing with sort of complex traumas as well as the day-to-day cases. So it's a situation is quite difficult for the average Ukrainian to receive healthcare.
And obviously, there's a big difference between some of the worst hit regions and then some of the regions that are trying to go about some kind of normal life. What's the infrastructure like in those worst hit regions?
As far as we understand, obviously, it's limited due to attacks on the infrastructure. So there's sort of power outages, there's shortages of material. So understandably, in those eastern part of the countries, those most affected regions, it is quite limited. However, Ukraine is sort of trying to spread the burden out through the entire country. So we have regions in the west which are also absorbing some patients to help alleviate the problems in the east.
Yeah, so you're kind of working, that's the atmosphere that you're working in day to day. Can you tell us a little bit about your own job and what you do?
Yes, so I'm an emergency response officer. So basically, I work at a place called the Emergency Response Coordination Center, the ERCC. And this is sort of the department of the commission that deals with both civil protection and humanitarian aid operations. I try to explain this to my four-year-old when she asks me, what do I do? And I try to, for those who know Fireman Sam, I try to tell her that basically I'm Station Officer Steele. So we're essentially the fire station for the world. So I work in an operation center where if there's a disaster that requires international assistance, a country can contact us, and then we will then begin coordination efforts within Europe. And this includes all the 27 EU member states, as well as 10 other countries, who can then pool their capacities to respond to a disaster. So it's, in short, it's basically a very well-connected fire station.
So that Medevac Hub that you are working on is part of the EU response to this healthcare crisis in Ukraine. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, indeed. So when the war began and we started to evacuate Ukrainians across Europe, we soon realized that we needed a sort of staging area very close to Ukraine where we can then receive patients prior to them going onwards to receiving hospitals. So in September 2022, we've established the hub along with our Polish colleagues, so a Polish NGO and the Polish government, to provide basically once the Ukrainians get evacuated, they arrive in the nearest town that has the large airport, Rzeszów, Poland, where they'll receive basic treatment as well as evaluations before they're then transported onwards to the receiving hospitals. So it's a staging area that provides basic medical care. Additionally, the Medevac hub is quite useful because if a patient were to then deteriorate, they can do a initial treatment and then transfer the patient to local hospitals. So also, I would say, you remind the listeners that Ukraine is a very large country. So when patients are traveling from the east, it's quite a journey. So it allows also the Ukrainians to rest for a day prior to their onward transport.
And what's that journey like for patients? Are they like journeying by road, by train, by air?
Generally, it's all three. I mean, obviously, using aerial means is not common, although it does happen in the eastern parts of the country. However, the majority of the patients are transported by road and by rail. And so if they are going from the eastern front to Lviv and then onward to Poland, we're talking about sometimes a 16-hour journey. So it's quite an arduous journey. There are stops along the way. Ukraine has set up their own medical hubs to receive patients before they then get transported. So generally, it's not done in one go. And this way, it's easier for both the patients and their family members.
Yeah, we've talked on this podcast before to people in Ukraine, you know, from the front lines and trying, you know, to live ordinary lives in the cities. And it's the kind of aspects that you don't think about, that, you know, everyday healthcare or extreme healthcare that people need. For the people in Rzeszów, how many people are working on the ground in the hub, and what kind of jobs are they doing? Are they all medical staff, or what's the most common kind of person working on the ground?
In Rzeszów, it's a mix of paramedics as well as doctors and interpreters. And so their specialties go from sort of psychosocial support to trauma and basic nursing. So it's quite a mix to address any possible need that may come across the border. Again, the medevac hub is a sort of a staging area for onward flight, but we also realize that there are certain injuries that cannot be treated there and would increase the risk to the patients. So the really critical care patients, they go straight from Ukraine to the medevac flight because there's sort of ICU capacity within the flight. So we want to try to make the transport as comfortable as possible for the patients, but also reduce any potential risk that the patients may have.
And where are they going onwards to?
Well, so far we've had 22 countries throughout Europe, except patients. So the largest majority of patients have gone so far to Germany, followed by Norway. But again, these countries include Spain, the Netherlands, and obviously Ireland as well. So it's many different countries supporting this initiative.
And we're talking about the people who are being transported. Are we talking about people who are wounded in the war, or ordinary civilians who need things like cancer treatment or surgeries for injuries?
In fact, it's both. So we have the majority of patients now are trauma patients, both soldiers and civilians injured in the war. But we also have quite a few cancer or chronic disease patients. I mean, so the war has really affected the entire healthcare system. I mean, no healthcare system is sort of established to address the needs of a full-scale war. I mean, it would be inefficient. So this way, by transporting both trauma and chronic illness patients, we can really then show solidarity with Ukraine and support the overall healthcare need.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Is there a difference then in how you have to deal with soldiers and with ordinary civilians?
Essentially, look, the process is the same. We receive a request from Ukraine and we try to protect the patient's privacy rights as much as possible. So we don't know their names. We just know the basic details, initials, date of birth, and what they're afflicted by. And then countries then make offers based on their capacities to treat these patients. Some countries, I would have to say, they don't accept Ukrainian soldiers, and this is just due to sort of internal legislation. However, the vast majority of countries do accept both soldiers and civilians, but the process is the same.
You mentioned earlier that some of the very serious injuries or critical patients don't go to the hub. So what kind of treatment is provided at the hub, if any?
So if a patient arrives and they need bandages changed or medication, or even some of the less traumatic cases, they just need to have a night's sleep and a cup of coffee, they will receive that. There's a children's playroom as well, so the accompanying children can play, or the patients, if they're pediatric, they also have a way to sort of relieve stress, the stress of the journey. Wounds are cleaned, and the final assessment is made whether the patient is fit for transport. So it's basic medical care. And if the patient were to deteriorate, I think we had two or three instances where the medical staff evaluated the patient and they recognized that the patient was not in a good shape at the moment. And they provided immediate treatment and transferred the patient to a hospital. So it's a very competent and qualified organization. So it's a Polish NGO called PCPM. And so they really do a great job in supporting the operations.
And where does the money come from?
So the money is almost entirely funded by the European Commission, so DG ECHO, which is our office, again, the Office for Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations. Also, the Polish government supports a bit of the funding as well. So in terms, this is almost an entirely EU-funded initiative.
So you mentioned the 22 countries and people go to different countries. So what dictates who goes where and when?
So the way the process works, as I mentioned, Ukraine asked for assistance for particular patients. And this information is shared amongst all of our member states and our participating states. And they can then, the countries then share this information with the ministries of health. And then they evaluate based on internal capacity, whether they can receive a patient and whether they have the available means for these patients. Once they receive a positive response, they make an offer to accept a particular patient. And we may receive one offer, or we may receive multiple offers for a patient. And then it's up to the Ukrainian authorities and the patients to decide whether they accept those offers of treatment. So it really depends. It's really on a case-by-case basis. So there's no one specific criteria that would say a patient goes to one particular country or another.
Earlier, you said 27 member states plus 10 other countries are involved. Do they all make offers of some kind to take patients in?
It depends week by week. I mean, only 22 countries. Well, I wouldn't say only, but 22 countries have offered. So some countries do it on a regular basis, whereas others do it sort of with a gap maybe of a few weeks or a few months. So it really depends on internal capacities.
And is it always about taking the patient in, or is there other things that countries can help out with?
Well, for example, it's quite interesting because you have some countries who receive and treat the patients. However, they don't have, for whatever reason, the possibility to provide transport. This is often due just to legal reasons or operational reasons where the funding may not be available for this project. And then what we've done is we have other countries who then have the transport resources, specialized medical airplanes, who would then transport patients to the receiving country. So even if a country has the potential to treat, but not the transport means, we can then come up with a solution. And I would like to highlight sort of the work done by Norway in this respect. Norway has a very large airplane, which can transport nearly 40 patients at a time. And often they are the main transporters of patients from Poland to countries throughout Europe. Romania also has been involved in this as well, just to name another country. And Romania specifically because they've also transported patients to Ireland in the initial stages when Ireland was making offers for patients and Romania provided the transport. So also, it's for me, this is a very good example of European solidarity and sort of the sharing of the burden to help as many people as possible.
I was just thinking that because Ireland wouldn't be known for our ability to transport from the island and to and from the island. So that's really interesting. Ireland has welcomed 28 patients through these operations. How did that come about? Is there any specialist care in particular that Ireland makes offers on, or was it timing?
Actually, it's been quite balanced, in fact. So I just had a look at the cases through Ireland, and about half are trauma and half are cancer or chronic diseases, and with also pediatric cases as well. So it's a mix of patients, and again, it's really based on the capacity available to treat the patients. I mean, Ireland, if we compare it to the size of Germany, is a relatively population small country. So they're really making their efforts to contribute in this operation, and we're very grateful for that.
Overall, what's the scale of this operation compared to other projects the ERCC would be involved in?
Well, it's interesting in this because in civil protection, our operations are generally only a few weeks or a few months long. However, sort of Ukraine, the situation in Ukraine has sort of turned everything on its head, and we've been engaged again for more than 2 years. So, as far as duration, it's been one of the largest operations the largest operation we've conducted, and it's quite complex. I mean, I think when the war broke out, we couldn't have imagined that we would start medical evacuations. We, I mean, prior to the war, we were sort of very focused on particular types of evacuations, and we've done I would say, even a handful. And now we're looking at probably the largest multinational medical evacuation conducted by civilians ever. So this is quite, you know, we're at, I believe, over 3,000 patients evacuated to this moment. So it's quite a large operation, and we intend to continue this for as long as the need is there.
The ERCC is an example of how the EU responds, not in a bureaucratic way or in a diplomatic way, but in a more tangible way to crises and disasters. Can you give us a couple of other examples of the kind of work the ERCC does?
Yeah, thank you. This is also, I also try to explain this in many ways, because, you know, I think myself included, look at the EU as this sort of bureaucratic thing, and what do we actually do? And the ERCC is quite down to earth, operational. We put feet on the ground during a crisis. For example, if there is a forest fire in I'll use Sweden, for example, several years ago, major forest fires in Sweden. We have countries that have a high force firefighting capacities, firefighters, equipment, planes. So the ERCC then coordinates with Sweden and an offering country to send those planes and firefighters to help support the Swedish response. So firefighting, force firefighting is one big area which we're very active. And something maybe a bit more obscure, just a few months ago, we sent an advisory mission to Iceland, which comprised volcanologists, to help develop a plan to potentially cool the lava, which threatened a power station. I mean, this was quite unique. I'd never heard of anything like this, but apparently it had been done before in the 70s, and there were expertise in Europe to do this. So, I mean, so we can really garner all the benefits of expertise in Europe to support a response, whether it be search and rescue teams or flood containment. So we are sort of the active arm of the European Commission. In addition to that, we also do advisory missions, where we send experts to anywhere in the world to help support the capacity to respond to a disaster.
You yourself, have you been based purely in Poland, or have you been in Ukraine as well?
I was initially, I was based in Poland. I did two or three rotations to Poland to help set up the Medevac hub. And then I went to Ukraine twice as part of an advisory mission to reinforce the Medevac process. So we decided, along with the Ukrainians, that it'd be good to sort of optimize the system to really to tailor the needs and strengthen areas which needed additional support, notably for burns patients or fast tracking evacuations of really critical patients. So I conducted a mission with members from several countries, and we went to Dnipro, Kyiv, and Lviv during the mission to visit sort of the various points in the chain of the Medevac process.
How are doctors and other healthcare workers coping at the moment?
Really, I have tremendous, tremendous amount of respect for the Ukrainian medical staff. I mean, they are, and quite understandably, very, very worked. They're doing their best. Doctors are fulfilling roles of many different roles that they probably didn't do prior to the war. And, you know, in many ways, Ukraine is the same as Europe. They suffer the same sort of challenges within the medical profession that other European countries have: shortages of nurses, different medical staff. And then we compound that by a lot of people leaving Ukraine during the initial part of the war. So the staff shortage became even more acute. So they are very, very, very hard. They're working very hard to address these issues, and we can support them as best as we can by this Medevac operation.
On the other end of the Medevac operation, then, so people, you know, get transported to Germany or to Ireland and have their treatment. Do they go back to Ukraine? Do they recuperate in the country they are? Do they stay? Or is there a case by case basis approach?
This really is a case by case. I mean, obviously the military injured, they're required to return if they're able to return. But there are many, many different scenarios. Some patients return to Ukraine on their own volition. They travel back. The area of returns echo We follow this with colleagues from other European agencies, as well as the Ukrainian authorities, but it's really an operation which occurs apart from the medevac operation. So it's being supported by financially by other EU organizations, as well as the Ukrainians. And Ukraine, they follow up on all the patients evacuated to see how they are getting along, whether they've integrated, or if there's any sort of issues that they may arise during the during their time overseas.
And just on the medevac hub, then, it's obviously been there longer than would have been anticipated as the war goes on. Will it remain there for the duration of the war, or could it even be expanded?
The plan is now to remain as long as necessary. We review the operationality of the hub every several months, and we sort of extend our presence there based on need. So the hub is going to be there throughout the rest of this year, as well as the evacuation plane will also be available. So we look at this depending on the needs on the ground. But if there's a need to expand, and hopefully not, we will address this need if it arises.
Eric, thanks so much for coming on and explaining all that to us. It makes a difference that we can hear from people so that we can try to understand the everyday lives of people, soldiers and ordinary citizens in Ukraine, what they're going through and what the war is putting them through. So thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with the rest of the operation.
Thank you again. And I also want to thank the listeners and specifically Ireland for the support in this operation. And we will continue to do our best.
Thank you for listening to The Explainer, and a big thank you to Eric for joining me. This episode of The Explainer was brought to you by senior producer Nikki Ryan. It was sponsored by DG Echo. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us so we can continue to make more just like this one. There's a couple of things you can do. Head to thejournal.ie/contribute to become a monthly subscriber, or make a one-off donation. You can also leave us a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. It's a great way to make sure other people can discover it, listen, and love it as well. Thank you, and catch you next time.